the aqueduct past the voters than it faced the more difficult task of getting it past Congress. Most of the lands it would traverse belonged to the government, so the city would have to appeal for rights of way. The reclamation project, though moribund, was still not officially deauthorized, which was, at the very least, a nuisance to the city. But deauthorization could prove to be even worse, because tens of thousands of acres that the service had withdrawn would return to the public domain and be available for homesteading. Homesteading in California was another name for graft. Half of the great private empires were amassed by hiring homesteaders to con the government out of its land. If the withdrawn lands went back to the public domain, every available water right would be coveted by speculators for future resale to the city. Mulholland seemed to believe that the city would never require more water, but others, notably Joseph Lippincott, thought him wrong. The withdrawn lands had to be kept off-limits at all costs. The instrument for achieving this wishful goal was a bill introduced at the behest of Mulholland's chief lawyer, William B. Matthews, by Senator Frank Flint of California, a strong partisan of Los Angeles and urban water development in general. The bill would give the city whatever rights of way it needed across federal lands and hold the withdrawn lands in quarantine for another 3 years, which would presumably give the city enough time to purchase whatever additional water or land it might need. Flint's bill reached the Senate floor in June of 1906 and flew through easily. Its next stop, however, was the House Public Lands Committee, where it crashed into Congressman Sylvester Smith. Smith was an energetic and charming politician, a former newspaper publisher from Bakersfield with a sense of public duty and enough money to maintain an ironclad set of principles. The idea of Harrison Gray Otis and Henry Huntington becoming vastly richer than they already were on water abducted from his district inflamed his well-developed sense of outrage. Smith knew what he was up against, however, and realized that his best defense was to appear utterly reasonable. As a result, he said that he was willing to acknowledge the city's need for more water, that he was willing to let it have a substantial share of the Owens River, and that he was willing to grant the aqueduct its necessary rights of way. He was not willing, however, to do any of this in the way the city wanted. He suggested a compromise. Let the Reclamation Service build its project, including the big dam in Long Valley, a dam that could store most of the river's flow. The water could then be used first for irrigation, and because of the valley's long and narrow slope, the return flows would go back to the lower river, where they could be freely diverted by Los Angeles. The city would sacrifice some of the water it wanted. The valley would sacrifice some irrigable land. It was, Smith argued, an enlightened plan, sensible, efficient, conceived in harmony. It was the only plan under which no one would suffer. He would add only two stipulations. The Owens Valley would have a non-negotiable first right to the water, and any surplus water could not be used for irrigation in the San Fernando Valley. Smith's proposal was obviously anathema to the San Fernando Land Syndicate and to the city as well. The chief of the Geologic Survey doubted that it would work, and even if it did, for the West's largest city to settle for leftover water from a backwater oasis of fruit and cattle ranches was, to say the least, humiliating. The city might have to beg for extra water in times of drought, or go to court to try to condemn it. If the Owens Valley held on to its first rights and expanded its irrigated acreage, Los Angeles might soon have to look for water again, and the only river in sight was the Colorado, a feckless, brown torrent in a bottomless canyon which the city could never afford to dam and divert on its own. Smith's proposal led directly to one unthinkable conclusion. At some point in the relatively near future, Los Angeles would have to cease to grow. What was William Mulholland's response? He took a train to Washington, held a summit meeting with Smith and Senator Flint, and decided to do what any sensible person would have done. He accepted the compromise. If it was a smokescreen, as it appears to have been, it was a brilliant move. Mulholland seems to have been a far better political schemer than he was a hydrologist and civil engineer. For one thing, It put Sylvester Smith off guard, making him believe that the reconciliation he wanted to effect was a success. For another, it gave Los Angeles some critical extra time to plead its case before the two people who might help the city get everything it wanted. The President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, and the man on whom he leaned most heavily for advice, Gifford Pinchot. Pinchot was the first director of Roosevelt's pet creation, the Forest Service, but that was only one of his roles. He was also the Cardinal Richelieu of TR's White House. Temperamentally and ideologically, the two men fit hand in glove. Both were wealthy patricians. Pinchot came from Pittsburgh, where his family had made a fortune in the dry goods business. Both were hunters and outdoorsmen. Though their speeches and writings rang of Thomas Jefferson, at heart Pinchot and Roosevelt seemed more comfortable with Hamiltonian ideals. Roosevelt liked the reclamation program because he saw it as an agrarian path to industrial strength, not because he believed, as Jefferson did, that a nation of small farmers is a nation with a purer soul. Pinchot espoused forest conservation not because he worshipped nature like John Muir, whom he privately despised, but because the timber industry was plowing through the nation's forest with such abandon it threatened to destroy them for all time. Roosevelt was a trust-buster, but only because he feared that unfettered capitalism could breed socialism. For evidence, he had only to look as far as Los Angeles, where Harrison Gray Otis was whipping labor radicals into such a blind, vengeful froth that two of them blew up his printing plant in 1910 and killed 20 of their own. The conservation of Roosevelt and Pinchot was utilitarian. Their progressivism, they spoke of the greater good for the greatest number, had a nice ring to it, but it also happens to be the progressivism of cancer cells. On the evening of June 23rd, Senator Frank Flint left his offices on Capitol Hill for a late meeting with the president. It was a hot and muggy night, and Roosevelt seemed in an irritable mood. Behind him, however, stood a man who seemed a model of coolness and decorum, Gifford Pinchot. Flint, who had just received an intensive coaching from Matthews and Mulholland, began a passionate appeal. Smith's so-called compromise, he said, was nothing less than capitulation. Los Angeles had agreed only in despair. It was going to run out of water any day, and it couldn't afford to be filibustered to death in Congress. Smith's prohibition on using surplus water in the San Fernando Valley left the city no choice but to leave any surplus in the Owens Valley or dump it in the ocean. In the first case, water rights the city had purchased at great expense might revert to the valley under the doctrine of appropriative rights. In the second case, the city would violate the California Constitution, which forbade inefficient use of water. The real estate bust of 1889 had depopulated the city by one half. Imagine what a water famine would do. All of the city's actions in the Owens Valley had been legitimate. It had paid for its water, fair and square, and it wanted to let the valley survive. But there was only so much water, and it was 100-fold, 1,000-fold, said Smith, more valuable to the state and the nation if it built up a great, strong, progressive city on America's weakly defended western flank, instead of maintaining a little agrarian utopia in the high desert. It was a rousing speech, the kind of speech that Roosevelt liked to hear. It was, in fact, just the kind of speech he would have made. Roosevelt turned to his other visitor. "What do you think about this, Giff?" "As far as I am concerned," Pinchot answered coolly, "there is no objection to permitting Los Angeles to use the water for irrigation purposes." It was as simple as that. Roosevelt did not even bother to call in the Interior Department's lawyers or the Geologic Survey's hydrologists to ask whether Flint's argument was sense or nonsense. He never invited Sylvester Smith to give his side of the argument. He didn't even tell Smith, or his own interior secretary, Ethan Hitchcock, about his decision. They found out about it secondhand a day and a half later. Hitchcock, a wealthy, principled man in the style of Sylvester Smith, had been profoundly embarrassed by the two-faced behavior of his employee J.P. Lippincott, and had been looking for a way to make amends to the Owens Valley. Flabbergasted and infuriated by the president's decision, Hitchcock raced over to the White House, where Roosevelt refused to hear him. Instead, he forced him to suffer the humiliation of helping him draft a letter explaining our attitude in the Los Angeles water supply question. As Hitchcock stood by, impotent and enraged, Roosevelt wrote, "It is 100 or 1,000-fold more important to state that this water is more valuable to the people of Los Angeles than to the Owens Valley." The words could have come right out of William Mulholland's mouth. The Otis, Sherman, Huntington, Chandler land syndicate was, potentially, enough of an embarrassment to Roosevelt's anti-monopolist image that he felt compelled to add an amendment to Flint's bill prohibiting the city from reselling municipal water for irrigation use. In the opinion of House Public Lands Committee, however, the stipulation was meaningless. "This water will belong absolutely to Los Angeles," said the bill's sponsor, echoing the sense of the committee, "and the city can do as it pleases," which it would. Roosevelt's support for Flint's bill was only the beginning of the aid and comfort he was to give to the most powerful city on the Pacific coast. When the Reclamation Service officially annulled the Owens Valley project in July of 1907, the hundreds of thousands of acres it had withdrawn were not returned to the public domain for homesteading, on Roosevelt's orders, just as Mulholland wished. It was a decision without precedent, and its result was that the handful of rich members of the San Fernando Syndicate could continue using the surplus water in the Owens River that thousands of homesteaders might have claimed instead. Ethan Hitchcock had promised that such a decision, which he already foresaw when Roosevelt closed ranks behind Los Angeles, would be made over his dead body. But Roosevelt spared his life by firing him first. And when the city, immensely satisfied with the result, asked Pinchot whether he could go a step further, the chief of the Forest Service decided to include virtually all of the Owens Valley in the Inyo National Forest. The Inyo National Forest! With 6 inches of annual rainfall, the Owens Valley is too dry for trees. The only ones there were fruit trees planted and irrigated by man, some of which were already dying for lack of water. This didn't seem to bother Pinchot, nor did the fact that his action appears to have been patently illegal. The Organic Act that created the Forest Service says, "No public forest reservation shall be established except to improve and protect the forest, or for the purpose of creating favorable conditions of water flow, and to provide a continuous supply of timber for the use and necessities of the United States." But it is not the purpose of these provisions to authorize the inclusion of lands more valuable for the mineral therein, or for agricultural purposes than for forest purposes, emphasis added. The valley's irrigated orchards were infinitely more valuable than the barren flats and scattered sagebrush that characterized the new national forest. So Pinchot's action was incontrovertibly a violation of the legislation that put him in business. He lamely countered that he was simply acting to protect the quality of Los Angeles's water. But since much of the treeless acreage he included in the Inyo National Forest lay below the intake of the aqueduct, it was a flimsy excuse. As a formality, Pinchot was obliged to send an investigator to the Owens Valley to recommend that he do what he had already made up his mind to do. He sent three before he found one who was willing to go along. "This is not a government by legislation," lamented Sylvester Smith on the Senate floor. "It is a government by strangulation." In July of 1907, with the reclamation project in its grave, and the Owens Valley imprisoned inside a national forest without trees, Joseph Lippincott resigned from the Reclamation Service and immediately went to work, at nearly double his government salary, as William Mulholland's deputy. He remained utterly unchastised. "I would do everything over again, just exactly as I did," he said as he departed. The one thing that no one seems to have thought about in all this was that the people of Owens Valley were only human, and there was just so much they could take. The aqueduct took 6 years to build. The Great Wall of China and the Panama Canal were bigger jobs, and New York's Catskill Aqueduct, which was soon to be completed, would carry more water, but no one had ever built anything so large across such merciless terrain, and no one had ever done it on such a minuscule budget. It was as if the city of Pendleton, Oregon, had gone out by itself and built Grand Coulee Dam. The aqueduct would traverse some of the most sissile, fractionated, fault-splinter topography in North America. It would cover 223 miles, 53 of them in tunnels. Where tunneling was too risky, there would be siphons whose acclivities and declivities exceeded 50 grade. The city would have to build 120 miles of railroad track, 500 miles of roads and trails, 240 miles of telephone line, and 170 miles of power transmission line. The entire concrete-making capacity of Los Angeles was not adequate for this one project. So a huge concrete plant would have to be built near the limestone deposits in the grimly arid Tehachapi Mountains. Since there was virtually no water along the entire route, steam power was out of the question, and the whole job would be done with electricity. Therefore, two hydroelectric plants would be needed on the Owens River to run electric machinery that a few months earlier had not even been invented. The city would have to maintain, house, and feed a workforce fluctuating between 2,000 and 6,000 men for six full years. And it would have to do all this for a sum equivalent, more or less, to the cost of one modern jet fighter. The workers would have to supply their own hard-shell derby hats, since hard hats did not yet exist, and even if they had, the city couldn't afford them. They would live in tents in the desert without liquor or women, although both were available nearby and ended up consuming most of the aqueduct payroll. They would eat meat that spoiled during the daytime and froze at night, since the daily temperature range in the Mojave Desert can span 80 degrees. Nonetheless, the men would labor on the aqueduct as the pious raised the cathedral at Chartres, and they would finish under budget and ahead of schedule. If you asked any of them why they did it, they would probably say they did it for the chief. The loyalty and heroics that Mulholland inspired in his workers were a perpetual source of wonder. For 6 years he all but lived in the desert, patrolling the aqueduct route like a nervous father-to-be pacing a hospital waiting room, giving advice, offering encouragement, sketching improvised solutions in the sand. In sandstorms, windstorms, snowstorms, and terrifying heat, his spirits remained contagiously high. Pilfering, which can add millions to the cost of a modern project, was almost unknown. Although the pay was terrible, Mulholland simply couldn't afford anything more, he initiated a bonus system that shattered records for hard rock tunneling. The men were in a race with the world's most illustrious tunnelers, the Swiss, who were digging the Lechberg Tunnel at the same time. Throughout the entire time, Mulholland showed the better side of a complex and sometimes heartless character. If he wandered through a tent city and discovered that a worker's wife had just had a baby, he would stop long enough to show her the proper way to change a diaper. He would sit down and eat with the men and complain louder than anyone about the food. In lieu of newspapers, his wit was breakfast conversation. Once, when a landslide sealed off a tunnel with a man still inside, Mulholland arrived to check on the rescue effort. "He's been in there 3 days, so I don't suppose he's doing so well," said the supervisor, a mirthless Scandinavian named Hansen. "Then he must be starving to death," said Mulholland. "Oh, no, sir," said the supervisor. "He's getting something to eat. We've been rolling him hard-boiled eggs through a pipe." "Have you?" said Mulholland archly. "Well, then, I hope you've been charging him board."
"No, sir," said the flustered Hansen. "But I suppose I should, eh?"
And Los Angeles loved Mulholland even more than the men, because its reward would be infinitely greater than theirs. To the thirsty city,
he was Moses. And he was that greater rarity, a Moses without political ambition. When a move was afoot a few years later to run him for mayor, Mulholland dismissed it with a typical bon mot. "I would rather give birth to a porcupine backwards than become the mayor of Los Angeles." But nothing that William Mulholland ever said or did quite matched the speech he gave when, on November 5, 1913, the first water cascaded down the aqueduct's final sluiceway into the San Fernando Valley. It had been a day of long speeches and waiting, and the crowd of 40,000 people was restless. Mulholland himself was exhausted. His wife was very ill, and he had slept only a few hours and several nights. When the white crest of water finally appeared at the top of the sluiceway and cascaded toward the valley, an apparition in a Syrian landscape, Mulholland simply unfurled an American flag, turned toward the mayor, H.H. Rose, and said, "There it is. Take it." It was the high point of Mulholland's life and career. Very little of the water that was, according to Theodore Roosevelt, 100 or 1,000-fold more important to Los Angeles than to the Owens Valley, would go to the city for another 20 years. All through the teens and early 20s, the San Fernando Valley used 3 times as much aqueduct water as the city itself, the vast part of it for irrigation. During one particularly wet year, every drop of the copious flow of the aqueduct went to irrigate San Fernando Valley crops. The city took nothing at all. Understandably, this news enraged the people of the Owens Valley. For Los Angeles to take their water to fill their wash tubs and water glasses was one thing. For it to turn their valley back to desert, so that another desert valley owned by rich monopolists could bloom in its place, was quite another. The teens and early 20s, however, were extraordinarily wet years, the same wet years that caused the Reclamation Service to overestimate dramatically the flow of the Colorado River, and there was enough water for everyone. The irrigated acreage in the San Fernando Valley rose from 3,000 acres in 1913, the year both the completion of the aqueduct and the annexation of the valley occurred, to 75,000 acres in 1918. Even so, the Owens Valley lost few of its orchards and irrigated pasture lands, and the new railroad to Los Angeles and the silver mine at Tonopah fed in enough wealth to allow the town of Bishop to build the Grand American Legion Hall and Masonic Temple, those cathedrals of the rural 19th century. The same uncharacteristically engorged desert river that was keeping the Owens Valley green was responsible, in Los Angeles, for the most transfixing change. Santa Monica Boulevard, once a dry, dusty strip, became an elegant corridor of palms. In Hollywood, where the motion picture industry had risen up overnight, outdoor sets resembled New Guinea. And since most Los Angelenos were immigrants from the Middle West, every bungalow had a green lawn. The glorious anomaly of a fake tropical city with a mild desert climate brought people from everywhere. Dirt farmers came from Arkansas. Aldous Huxley moved from England. The Chamber of Commerce, an Otis creation, kept them coming. They arrived on the Union Pacific, a Harriman railroad, and once they were there, the Times, an Otis and Chandler newspaper, urged everyone to settle in the San Fernando Valley, an Otis and Chandler property. Few could afford automobiles, so they got around on Sherman and Huntington trolley cars, between Sherman and Huntington built homes and Sherman and Huntington resorts in the San Gabriel and San Bernardino mountains. As Otis never tired of saying, this was the promised land. All things were possible. Anyone could get rich. The cardinal sin was doubt. During the nadir of the Depression, when the city was invaded by homeless Okies so destitute they sat hollow-eyed in the parks and gnawed on the crust thrown out for the pigeons, the Times sent them this holiday greeting. Merry Christmas. Look pleasant. Chin up. A gloomy face never gets a good picture. The great battles are fought by Caesars and their fortunes, by Napoleons and their stars. Faith still does the impossible. Merry Christmas. Catch the tempo of the times. You have your life before you. And if you are growing old, the greatest adventure of all is just around the corner. Earth may have little left in reserve, but heaven is ahead. Merry Christmas. The only greater fraud than such blather from Otis and Chandler's newspaper was the overflowing desert river on which all depended. In the West, drought tends to come in cycles of about 20 years, and the next drought arrived on schedule. The years 1919 and 1920 were a premonition. Rainfall was slightly below average. It rose back to average, a measly 14 inches, in 1921, and went slightly over that in 1922. Then it crashed. 10 inches in 1923, 6 inches in 1924, 7 inches in 1925. In Florida, a 7-inch rainstorm may occur 2 or 3 times a year, but Los Angeles was trying to look like Florida and grow even faster on a fifth of its precipitation, and when the drought struck, it kept going on a tenth. Mulholland had expected 350,000 people by 1925, but had 1.2 million on his hands instead. The city was growing 15 times faster than Denver, 11 times faster than New York. And though the city at its core had become a metropolis, Los Angeles County led the nation in the value of its agricultural output. All of this agriculture depended on irrigation, which, together with the phenomenal urban growth, depended on a river draining Mount Whitney 200 miles away. As the drought intensified, the Owens River moved perilously close to over-appropriation. The problem was not only that the river was small, but also that no carryover storage existed, nothing but some small receiving reservoirs around the basin and the snowfields in the Sierra. The Los Angeles Aqueduct was essentially a run-of-the-river project. If the river didn't run, the city collapsed. If the city and the Owens Valley were to continue sharing the river, carryover storage would have to be built. Otherwise, one place or the other would lose its water during a drought. Mulholland, of course, knew this, but still refused to build the dam at Long Valley. He blamed it on the city's fragile finances, but that was a poor excuse. The real reason was that he and his old friend Eaton had had a nasty falling out. Fred Eaton had not even bothered to attend the dedication of the aqueduct in 1913, though its existence was owed mainly to him. He had bought the initial water rights the city needed with his own money, taking a considerable risk. Had the voters failed to approve the bond referendum, he would have been drowning in both unusable water and debt. The city had paid him quite adequately for the right, but it had not made him a multimillionaire. Originally, Eaton had hoped to operate the Owens Valley end of the aqueduct as a private concession, which could have made him incredibly rich. But Frederick Newell and Roosevelt had dashed that dream, insisting that the project be municipally owned from end to end. Eaton had also had some bad luck in the cattle business, and had to switch ignominiously to chickens. He was 65 years old. It was time things finally went right. The one item of real value Eaton owned was the reservoir site on the ranch he had purchased from Thomas Rickey. Ideally, a dam built at the site ought to be 140 feet high, the approximate depth of the gorge. That would create a reservoir large enough to provide for both the city and the valley during all but the worst droughts. A dam site of such importance to the city, a site which, if developed, would drown a good portion of his ranch, was worth a lot of money, as far as Eaton was concerned. When Mulholland asked him what his price was, Eaton said $1 million. Mulholland, who seemed personally indifferent to money, though he was reputedly the highest-paid civil servant in California, laughed him off. Time and time again he asked Eaton to accept a reasonable offer, $500,000 perhaps, or a little more, and each time his offer was more angrily refused. By 1917, the two old friends were no longer on speaking terms. as the drought intensified, Mulholland begged the city fathers to end their abject deification of growth. The only way to solve a city's water problem, he grumbled aloud, was to kill the members of the Chamber of Commerce. When he was ignored, he began to regulate irrigation practices in the San Fernando Valley. First, he forbade the irrigation of alfalfa, a low-value, water-demanding crop. Then he prohibited winter planting. When these measures proved inadequate, he swallowed his disdain for surface storage and began building reservoirs in the basin. First the Hollywood Reservoir, then a much larger dam in San Francisquito Canyon, a deep fissure in the shaky, shaly topography of the Santa Paula Hills. With the tens of thousands of people pouring in each year, everything was a stopgap measure. By the early 1920s, Mulholland was already lobbying for an aqueduct from the Colorado River. This, however, put him on a collision course with Harry Chandler, who owned 860,000 acres in Mexico that relied on the Colorado, and who was so greedy that despite his enormous wealth, he put the interests of his Mexican holdings above the welfare of the city he had created out of whole cloth. Chandler's opposition, together with the fierce feuding among the Colorado River Basin states, kept the Boulder Canyon Project Act, which would create the storage reservoir that any Colorado River aqueduct would need, bottled up for years. Frustrated at every turn, Mulholland reached the end of his tether sometime in 1923. The only answer, he decided, was to do what Mary Austin had predicted the city would ultimately do, dry the Owens Valley up. The trouble began where troubles usually begin, in the heart. Wilfred and Mark Watterson, the brothers who symbolized the Owens Valley Mork Main and its success, had a young uncle named George, only 10 years older than Wilfred. George's attitude toward his nephews was less avuncular than competitive. Somehow in competition, George always lost. When Wilfred and George had filed rival claims on a mining right, Wilfred won. George had always wanted to own the first automobile in the valley, but one day he looked down the street and saw Wilfred drive up in a yellow Stanley steamer, mobbed by adoring crowds. Wilfred and Mark were treasurer of this, president of that. George Watterson was not even a has-been. He was a never-was. George Watterson had an ally in bitterness. Some years earlier, a lawyer with an adventuresome bent named Lester Hall had wandered into the Owens Valley from Alaska, taken one look at Wilfred and Mark's sister Elizabeth, and fallen helplessly in love. Elizabeth, however, had spurned him and married Jacob Clausen, Lippincott's former assistant, a symbol, like the Watterson brothers, of resistance to Los Angeles. The Owens Valley was a gossipy place, and the hatred that George Watterson felt for his nephews and the bitterness that Hall felt toward Jacob Clausen were well known. The city had its agents in the valley, and they had ears. When William Mulholland invited George Watterson, Hall, and their friend William Simons down for dinner at his club one evening, they were happy to come. The tactic was the old reliable one, the lightning strike. Simons was the president of the McNally Ditch, which held the oldest and largest water right among all the irrigation cooperatives in the valley. Hall and George Watterson were officers in the Bishop Creek Ditch and the Owens River Canal Company. On March 15, 1923, the three men returned to the valley and went immediately to work. "Leave none of the ranchers out," Mulholland had told them. "We want them all." Within 24 hours, Watterson, Simons, and Hall owned options on more than two-thirds of the McNally Ditch's water rights. They had paid as much as $7,500 per cubic second foot of water, and the total cost to the city was more than $1 million, the price Fred Eaton had wanted for access to his dam site. The size and length of an irrigation ditch depend critically on the number of people who use it. Since all the irrigators must spend a substantial amount of time maintaining it, clearing out weeds, desilting it, repairing earth slides, Losing just a few farmers can put a terrible burden of responsibility on those who remain. So many farmers who belonged to the McNally ditch had sold out that the cooperative was quickly put out of its misery. Those who remained couldn't possibly maintain it by themselves, so ultimately they would have to sell out too. By the time the three men moved on the other ditch companies, however, pockets of resistance had formed, and they had to seek out the more avaricious or vulnerable souls. Hall had managed to raid the confidential files of the collective ditch companies, making off with critical information about who was in financial trouble, who was a poor farmer, who was inclined to move on. He and his collaborators, therefore, didn't waste much time on people who were unlikely to yield to temptation. They knew who would. But their strategy, a strategy of division and attrition, was especially cruel, not only because it placed an even larger burden of responsibility on the farmers and ranchers who held out, but because it pitted neighbor against neighbor, wife against husband, brother against brother. Meanwhile, the master strategist, off in Los Angeles, was 69 years old and a changed man. 30 years earlier, Mulholland had spent his idle hours in a cabin at one of the city's outlying reservoirs, reading the classics and planting poplars. When the city had first talked about tapping the Owens River, his concern about the valley's welfare led him to suggest that the city plant millions of trees, which the residents could sell for firewood to the barren mining camps in Nevada, until someone informed him that so many trees would suck up enough groundwater to bleed the river dry. In his later years, however, the William Mulholland who had read Shakespeare and quoted Alexander Pope was hardly recognizable. No person ever put his imprint on an agency as strongly as Mulholland left his on the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. And that agency was now using secret agents, breaking into private records, and turning neighbors into mortal foes. And, worst of all, Mulholland was ignoring a solution that would have satisfied everyone. A dam at Long Valley, out of petty niggardliness and almost fanatical pride. In 1980, there were few people still alive who remembered Mulholland, but one who did was Horace Albright, the director of the National Park Service under Herbert Hoover. Albright could no longer remember the year. He was 82. But it was probably 1925 or 1926, and he was a young park superintendent invited to attend a testimonial dinner for Senator Frank Flint, the man who had engineered the dubious federal decisions that allowed the Owens Valley Aqueduct to be built. Albright was seated at Mulholland's table, a couple of chairs away, and midway through dinner he felt a rough tap on his shoulders. "You're from the Park Service, aren't you?" Mulholland demanded, more than asked. "Yes, I am," said Albright. "Why do you ask?" "Why?" Mulholland said archly. "Why? I'll tell you why. You have a beautiful park up north, a majestic park. Yosemite Park, it's called. You've been there, have you?" Albright said he had. He was the park superintendent. "Well, I'm going to tell you what I do with your park. Do you want to know what I would do?" Albright said he did. "Well, I'll tell you. You know this new photographic process they've invented? It's called Pathé. It makes everything seem lifelike. The hues and coloration are magnificent. Well, then, what I would do, if I were a custodian of your park, is I'd hire a dozen of the best photographers in the world. I'd build them cabins in Yosemite Valley and pay them something and give them all the film they wanted. I'd say, 'This park is yours. It's yours for 1 year. I want you to take photographs in every season. I want you to capture all the colors, all the waterfalls, all the snow, and all the majesty. I especially want you to photograph the rivers. In the early summer, when the Merced River roars, I want to see that. And then I'd leave them be. And in a year I'd come back and take their film and send it out and have it developed and treated by Pathé. And then I would print the pictures in thousands of books and send them to every library. I would urge every magazine in the country to print them and tell every gallery and museum to hang them. I would make certain that every American saw them.
And then, Mulholland said slowly, with what Albright remembered as a vulpine grin,
and then do you know what I would do? I'd go in there and build the dam from one side of that valley to the other and stop the goddamned waste.
It was the tone of his voice that surprised me, Albright said. The laughingly arrogant tone. I don't think he was joking, you see. He was absolutely convinced that building a dam in Yosemite Valley was the proper thing to do. We had few big dams in California then. There were hundreds of other sites, and there were bigger rivers than the Merced. But he seemed to want to shake things up, to outrage me. He almost wanted to destroy. It was the same tone, the same bitter and unreasoning quarrelsomeness that Mulholland displayed when a reporter from the Times asked him why there was so much dissatisfaction in the Owens Valley.
"Dissatisfaction in the valley?" said Mulholland mockingly.
"Yes, a lot of it. Dissatisfaction is a sort of condition that prevails there, like foot-and-mouth disease." It was the same unreasoning rage that made him say, when his war of attrition against the Owens Valley had finally caused events to take a drastic turn for the worse, that he half regretted the demise of so many of the valley's orchard trees, because now there were no longer enough live trees to hang all the troublemakers who lived there. Trees or no trees, that George Watterson, Lester Hall, and William Simons had not yet been lynched themselves, said something about the valley's self-restraint. Simons and Watterson had prudently taken to carrying sidearms, but aside from an occasional curse or jeer, they were left alone. The valley thought it had a better means of taking revenge on the city than assassinating its agents. Soon after the McNally ditch coup was engineered, the ditch companies that still had control of their water began opening their headgates and letting water flood uselessly over their fields. Before long, only a trickle was reaching the intake of the aqueduct. Mulholland demanded that the diversions stop, but the farmers refused. In exasperation, he tried a bit of double psychology. He sent more purchasing agents to reinforce Watterson, Simons, and Hall, and at the same time sent his attorney, William Matthews, to meet with the ranchers to see if the matter could still come to an amicable settlement. Just hours before Matthews was scheduled to sit down with the ditch companies, however, Mulholland went into one of his sudden fits of anger and telephoned his maintenance crews to demolish the intake of the largest diverter, the Big Pine Canal. The reaction was instantaneous. The leaders of the Big Pine Company were the worst people Mulholland could have chosen to antagonize. The Watterson brothers, a resort operator and speculator named Carl Keogh, and Harry Glasscock, the incendiary editor of the Owens Valley Herald. As soon as news arrived of what was happening, a posse of 20 men bristling with guns roared out to the canal intake. As guns were trained on Mulholland's crew, the rest of the men dumped their equipment into the Owens River. The valley mood veered suddenly from bitterness to wild exuberance. "Los Angeles, it's your move now," exulted the Big Pine citizen. And yet, the Big Pine farmers were soon to prove as indifferent to the valley's fate as the members of the McNally ditch. When Mulholland shrewdly responded with ever higher offers for the cooperative's water rights, a majority, not including the Watterson brothers, finally agreed to sell out for a price of $15,000 per second foot, twice what the city had paid for the McNally ditch rights. Mulholland was jubilant, but victory carried a heavy price. To satisfy his vendetta against his oldest friend, he had now spent twice what the Long Valley dam site would have cost, and made himself evil incarnate throughout an entire valley as well. As the farmers who held out felt increasingly alone, their methods grew more and more violent. On May 21, 1924, a group of men broke into the Watterson brothers' warehouse,
stole 3 cases of dynamite and blew a large section of the aqueduct to smithereens. From that moment on, William Mulholland refused to refer to anyone in the Owens Valley by any other name than Dynamiter. Then in August, Lester Hall, who had been warned to stay away forever, returned to the valley and was abducted from a restaurant as he ate. He was driven blindfolded to a road's end, where he found himself facing a grim-looking group of men and a noose strung over a tree. Hall saved himself by uttering the Freemasons' distress call. There were so many Masons among the valley population that one was in the gang of would-be lynchers, and he managed to talk the others out of murder. But the dynamitings continued. When the Department of Water and Power released a report that recommended destroying all irrigation, those were the exact words, in the valley, and it turned out that the main author was Joseph P. Lippincott, the response was a fresh series of blasts. Glasscock's paper was now openly counseling sabotage. The Ku Klux Klan, sensing a perfect battle stage between Hollywood, which was to say cities, big business, liberalism, and Jews, and the small-town revanchist values it cherished, was sending recruiters into the valley and getting good results. Even Fred Eaton, after holding himself aloof, finally entered the fray against the city of which he had been mayor. "Wherever the hand of Los Angeles has touched Owens Valley," he wrote in a letter to the editor, "it has turned back into desert." Joseph Lippincott, whose one admirable quality may have been prescience, had said 20 years earlier that the Owens Valley was doomed as soon as Los Angeles obtained its first water right. Mulholland, however, kept insisting blindly that the valley could live on, he didn't say how, even as he turned life there into a kind of hell. No one knew when his neighbor would be approached and persuaded to sell out. No one knew when the city would move to condemn. No one knew when the armed guards who patrolled the aqueduct would receive orders to shoot to kill. "Suspicions are mutual and widespread," a visitor from Los Angeles observed. "The valley people are suspicious of each other, suspicious of newcomers, suspicious of city men, suspicious, in short, of almost everybody and everything. Owens Valley is full of whisperings, mutterings, recriminations." It seemed only a matter of time before the onset of real war. On November 16, 1924, as the drought continued to hold Los Angeles in a deadly grip, a caravan of automobiles rumbled slowly southward through the town of Independence. In the first car, behind drawn blinds, sat the grim figure of Mark Watterson. The cars turned toward the Alabama Hills, a small range of barren rises at the foot of the Sierra Escarpment. Weaving through the hills was the Owens River Aqueduct, and somewhere along its course were the Alabama Gates. In wetter times, the gates had turned floodwaters in the aqueduct onto the desert to keep them from straining the capacity of the siphons below. They hadn't been used in years, but they still worked. When the caravan arrived at the gatehouse, 100 men got out of the cars, walked up to the spillway, and turned the 5 huge wheels that moved the weirs. For the first time in many years, the Owens River flowed back across the desert into Owens Lake. The effect of the seizure was electrifying. Mulholland was in a murderous rage. He dispatched 2 carloads of armed city detectives to take back the gates, but news of their imminent arrival prompted the local sheriff to go down to meet them. "If you go up there and start trouble," he told the detectives, "I don't believe you will live to tell the tale." They never went. Mulholland, in the meantime, secured a court injunction against the seizure, but when the papers were served to the men at the gates, they threw them into the water. And then, to everyone's surprise, what could easily have produced bloodshed turned into a picnic. Wives, children, grandmothers, and dogs joined the lawbreakers. Tom Mix was filming a movie nearby, and when he heard what was happening, he sent over his salutations and his orchestra. By evening, a huge cloud of smoke began to rise from the scene, but it came from a barbecue pit. After dinner, the sheriff arrived and joined in. The crowd was now 700 strong, and the strains of Onward Christian Soldiers filled the desert night. Events were finally swinging to the Owens Valley side. To Mulholland's disgust, even the Los Angeles Times, now that Otis was dead, was sympathizing with the lawbreakers. "These farmers are not anarchists or bomb throwers," it said in an editorial, "but in the main, honest, hard-working American citizens. They have put themselves hopelessly in the wrong by taking the law into their own hands, but that is not to say that there has not been a measure of justice on their side." Meanwhile, as Mark Watterson led the seizure of the Alabama gates, Wilfred had wisely gone to Los Angeles to closet himself with the Joint Clearinghouse Association, a roundtable of the city's bankers. After several hours, he emerged and sent Mark a telegram. "If the object of the crowd at the spillway is to bring their wrongs to the attention of the citizens of Los Angeles, they have done so 100%, he wired. "I feel sure that the wrongs done will be remedied." But such a simple happy ending could occur only on a Hollywood movie lot. As soon as the Alabama gates were released and Wilfred Watterson had returned home, the bankers with whom he had met rejected his price for the Consolidated Valley water rights, to which he swore they had agreed. Meanwhile, Mulholland's public relations department was flooding the state with a booklet explaining the Owens Valley crisis. "Never in its history has the Owens Valley prospered and increased in wealth as it has in the past 20 years, it said. And it was true, as long as you looked at only the first 19 of those years. In the 12 subsequent months, the city had almost brought the valley to its knees. Shops and stores were closing for lack of business. Thousands of people had already moved out. But Mulholland dismissed pleas for reparations out of hand. If business was down, he said, the shopkeepers could move too." The first order to shoot to kill came on May 28, 1927, a day after the no-name siphon, a huge pipe across a Mojave Hill, lay in shards, demolished by a tremendous blast of dynamite. As city crews hauled in 450 feet of new 12-foot pipe, another blast destroyed 60 feet of the aqueduct near Big Pine Creek. On June 4th, another 150 feet went sky-high. In response, a special train loaded with city detectives armed with high-velocity Winchester carbines and machine guns rolled out of Union Station for the Owens Valley. Roadblocks were erected on the highways. All cars with male occupants were searched. Floodlights beamed across the valley as if it were a giant penitentiary. Miraculously, though the Owens Valley water war had gone on for more than 20 years, though it had turned violent during the past 3, there were still no corpses. Harry Glasscock, however, was predicting in his editorial columns that the aqueduct would run red with human blood, and no one was prepared to argue with him. But before it could happen, fate cast a plague on both houses. First came the collapse of the Watterson banks, and the revelation that the Owens Valley's leading citizens were felons. Then, a few months later, came the collapse of the St. Francis Dam. The relationship between George Watterson and his two nephews had gone from one of competitiveness to one of bitterness to one of rancid hatred. In the early months of 1927, George saw his opportunity to invest in their final ruin. 4 years of drought and rapidly declining business had left all 5 branches of the Inyo County Bank severely weakened. At the same time, the election of a new governor, Clement Young, on a huge infusion of campaign cash from A.P. Giannini and his Bank of Italy, had resulted in the liberalization of the state banking laws, mainly to Giannini's advantage. It was no surprise, then, when George Watterson filed, in the name of the Bank of Italy, an application to launch a competitive bank in Inyo County. But it was no surprise either when the State Banking Commissioner voided the application on the strength of Wilfred Waterson's testimony that the bank was a front which Los Angeles would use to drive the valley into submission. Nor was it a surprise when, in response, an infuriated George Waterson, with considerable help from the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, began a dirt-gathering investigation into his nephew's bank. The surprise was what they ultimately found. To say that the Watersons had played fast and loose with their investors' capital was an understatement. For at least the past 2 years, they had been using the amalgamated capital of the Owens Valley to shore up their failing financial empire, their resort, the Mineral Water Company, their tungsten mine. They had recorded deposits in other banks that were never made, recorded debits that were already paid, entered balances that never existed on ledger sheets. They had loaned the entire life savings of their friends and neighbors to enterprises which were, at best, unlikely to succeed. When it was all tallied, there was a $2.3 million discrepancy between the bank books and reality. The brothers had always been the valley's best and last hope. Now, they were going to go to jail for embezzlement and fraud. They had done it, they said, for the good of the valley. And as outrageous as it sounded, it was probably true. None of the money had ever left Inyo County. With the irrigation economy dying at the hands of Los Angeles, the valley's only chance of surviving at all was to develop its minerals, its mining, its potential for tourism. During the trial, people who had lost everything nodded and agreed. Even as the Watersons were being charged with 36 counts of embezzlement and grand theft, the citizens of Owens Valley were pledging $1 million to keep them in business. It was too late. On August 4, 1927, all five banks were permanently closed. People wandered over to gawk at their final sign of defeat, a bitter message posted on the door. This result has been brought about by the past 4 years of destructive work carried on by the city of Los Angeles. The prosecuting attorney was a lifelong friend of both Wilfred and Mark. If he had not been the prosecutor, he said, he would have agreed to be a character witness. He cried openly as he made his final argument, and the judge and jury wept along with him. On November 14th, the Watersons were sent to San Quentin for 10 years, later reduced to 6. As the train taking them to San Francisco passed outside Bishop, someone was putting up a sign. It read, Los Angeles City Limits. William Mulholland had only 4 months to savor his triumph. By refusing to pay Fred Eaton the $1 million he wanted for his reservoir site, Mulholland had left himself short of water storage capacity. It was a serious situation to begin with, and it was compounded by the drought, the dynamitings, and the phenomenal continuing influx of people. His power dams were also running day and night, spilling water into the ocean before it could be reused. The water he had obtained at such expense and grief was being wasted. As a result, he turned to the dam he had under construction in San Francisquito Canyon, and ignoring the advice of his own engineers, decided to make it larger. The reservoir behind the enlarged St. Francis Dam reached its capacity of 11.4 billion gallons in early March of 1928 and immediately began to leak. Few dams fail to leak when they are new, but if they are sound, they leak clear water. The water seeping around the abutment of the St. Francis Dam was brown. It was a telltale sign that water was seeping through the canyon walls, softening the mica shale and conglomerate abutment. It was also a sign that William Mulholland chose, if not exactly to ignore, then to disbelieve. After all, it was his dam. Would the greatest engineering department in the entire world build an unsafe dam? To reassure the public, Mulholland and his chief engineer rode out to the site on March 12th for an inspection. The last of the season's rains was falling, and muddy water was running from a nearby construction site. After a perfunctory look, Mulholland decided that the site was the source of the mud, and pronounced the dam safe. On the same night, at a few minutes before